passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Are you looking to upgrade your game on and off the field? Triple Crown Jewelry makes the cleanest jewelry in the game so you can show your style. Their jewelry is made by athletes for athletes with durability and style in mind. They make the best-selling number pendants and chains that you're already seeing on the field. Whether your style is gold, matte black, or silver, Triple Crown Jewelry has what you need. Personally, I'm more about the silver, but Triple Crown is ready for whatever your style. The chains look great. They're durable with a shine that stands out, and when you put it on, it has a nice heft to it. You can feel the quality. Your number is yours. It's part of your identity, and Triple Crown knows that. They have numbers from 00 to 99 available, so you can show your number, your identity, on and off the field. Their jewelry will never turn your neck green or fade. They're tarnish resistant and made to last. These aren't just accessories. They're a statement of your dedication and love for the game. And that shine is unmatched. And in addition to choosing between the three different finishes, you can also choose from a variety of chains, including rope, Franco, and Cuban chains. So try it yourself. If you're ready to elevate your drip on and off the field, get some new drip at triplecrownjewelry.com and get a special discount just for our listeners. Get 25% off your first order site-wide with promo code BA2022. That's BA2022 at triplecrownjewelry.com. And by doing so, you're supporting our podcast. Orders are shipped the same or next business day from New Jersey, and orders over $50 get free shipping. Don't miss out on the opportunity to make a statement both on and off the field. Go to triplecrownjewelry.com and lead the league in drip.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me, as always, is my colleague Joe Healy. And joining us a little bit later will be Charlotte head coach Robert Woodard, who will join us to talk a little bit about how Charlotte is approaching summer ball, in terms of playing and not playing players and how you continue development. His first year with the program, and with the news of North Carolina's Mike Fox's retirement, Woodard, who played and coached under Fox, we'll get into that a little bit. And I guess, Joe, that's a relevant point to start with here. We are recording on August 7, which was last Friday, which was the day Mike Fox announced his retirement after 22 seasons at North Carolina, 37 years of head coaching between UNC and North Carolina Wesleyan. He was the winningest active coach in the country this spring and now is stepping away to spend more time with his family. He, after the last 5 months, was just kind of reevaluating his priorities and everything, and is now going to go all in on spending time with his family. This is a move that kind of had been rumored for a while, and now it is coming to pass. And by for a while, I mean for the last couple of years. Scott Forbes, who spent the last 19 years on staff at UNC and played for Fox at North Carolina Wesleyan, was announced as the head coach in the same release that announced Fox's retirement. So randomly newsy Friday here in college baseball at the start of August. Joe and I will get to all of that and more. So Joe, there's a lot going on, but we're here in August, and we're continuing on with the Baseball America College podcast and rapidly getting close to the start of colleges around the country, especially with their early starts. Kids are headed back to campus, and before you know it, it'll be the fall. It's the summer here is flying by.
Yeah, I got well, a couple things there. First, let me hit you with this hypothetical. This is related to a Slack discussion we had internal at Baseball America Slack, where staffer Josh Norris, who many of you listeners out there might know, following on Twitter, reading his work, he saw a rooster outside of our office, which apparently this is a thing that happens. I'm fairly new. I was not aware of said rooster. Does that count as birding? That he saw a rooster outside and he like observed the rooster. I think it counts as birding. He said no.
I say no. First of all, Josh is like an active, actual birder. So I think we do have to defer to Josh. But I also say no because the rooster is a domestic bird. Even if this one may or may not be feral, I don't know. I wasn't there. But it's still a domestic bird.
Interesting. Okay. Well, that's an argument. I mean, Josh being an actual birder, I guess we do have to defer. And the domesticity part is interesting. I find that argument persuasive and compelling. I was inclined to say it is birding. Now I'm obviously not sure, but just because it feels like we were making a value judgment on the rooster, that the rooster itself is not enough of a bird to be considered birding. And then so like that leads you down the road of like, well, where's the cutoff of like observing a pigeon, is that birding? Because when we see pigeons all the time, and you know, so I just felt like there was like a weird kind of evaluation being made there about why it wasn't birding. It's a good point about the domesticity. So that's, yeah, that's something, certainly something to think about there. Yeah, back on the topic of kids going back to school and colleges starting back up. And I think this, well, first of all, it really kind of hits you in the face, right? Like we've been talking about, a lot of the discussion has been through the prism of college football. And for a long time, it just felt like they were in this game of just kicking the can further and further down the road, and they were. But then all of a sudden, like the last couple of weeks, it's just kind of hit us in the face. Like, here's our schedules. We're doing a, you know, all conference play in the case of some conferences, or a 9+1, or a, you know, all the different models they're doing. And oh, by the way, here's our schedule grid, and it starts in a month in some cases. And so all of a sudden, here it is. Like, it really kind of smacked us in the face. And I think this has implications for baseball. You know, we won't know really until it happens what they are, but you know, how well this goes, whether or not football goes off without a hitch, what it means for, there are still more and more FCS schools, by the way, that are moving to spring schedules, that as we're recording now is kind of feels like the ball has picked up steam again in a lot of places at the FCS level. A lot of those FCS schools also play baseball. So I think we're going to learn a lot about what our college baseball season is going to look like just through how well football goes. And I think just as a general rubric, maybe you disagree a little bit, but I think as a general rule, the more normal, to the extent we can ever achieve normal right now, but the more normal football looks and feels and how well it goes, I think the more normal baseball will look to the extent that it can. I think disruptions, interruptions, and weirdness tends to cast a little more doubt onto, not doubt, but just I think creates a higher level of variability in what baseball looks like among the millions of unanswered questions we have. So I think I'm not alone in really watching this college football season, not only as a fan of the sport, but also as someone who cares about college baseball and seeing how this sport being played or not. And oh, by the way, basketball coming not far behind it, what kind of ramifications that'll have for baseball.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. The way football and the rest of the fall sports do or do not come off is going to be hugely important for winter sports and then eventually spring sports as well. You know, and the football question has added importance as places look to spring football as another option. So I wrote about this. You can read it over on the website about what a spring football season would mean for baseball. And so as these conferences and entire divisions now are making decisions about when they want to play their fall sports season, if they want to play it, you know, the Division III and Division II have already called off fall sports championships, which probably is going to mean that all the conferences canceled fall sports, like we saw in the spring. They said that they weren't going to move them to the spring, that moving them into the spring semester didn't make sense for them. But we've also seen the SWAC, which is one of the half dozen to 10 conferences, Division One, that have called off fall sports. They've already said that they want to put fall sports into the spring and come out with a rough outline of how that would happen. And other conferences are going to look at that. The Ivy League suggested they would look at that. And, you know, right now the biggest conferences are not looking at that. You know, Joe, you mentioned the schedule grids, the ACC and the Big Ten both came out with those this week. You know, I think the other conferences are not that much farther behind on presenting schedules. And so they're right now not really in a fall sports go to the spring mode, but that can change tomorrow. You know, things are fluid right now. So it's a thing that baseball and all other spring sports potentially will have to deal with. It has the potential to cause a massive amount of disruption if it came to that. You know, so just from a pure, like, let's get it played standpoint, you know, from baseball, like, that would be very significant, that they wouldn't have to worry about the disruption. And then, you know, everyone around college baseball is certainly rooting for a successful fall sports campaign, one, because of what that would mean for the pandemic and the response there, you know, to the pandemic. Two, because most of them just like watching football or soccer or, you know, the rest of the fall sports their schools compete in. And then three, because, you know, we've already had one season lost. Nobody wants to add another season to that. But, you know, we've seen various conferences, various levels, you know, junior college did it, have already been the bullet and moved fall sports to the spring or just canceled them outright. So it's definitely something to watch. A successful football season would give a whole lot of confidence, I think, to everyone in winter and spring sports that they too can be pulled off. Because if football can be pulled off, everything should be able to be pulled off. Football is obviously a massive undertaking. The roster sizes are the biggest. It's the most contact, like, it costs the most money, all on and on and on. Nothing else is really like it. And so if they can do that, they should be able to do just about anything, assuming conditions continue similarly.
It's certainly been a question on people's lips too. I don't know about you, but I've had more conversations, and I think some of it is driven by the fact that football has inched and then sped ever closer in recent days. But I've had the conversation about the spring baseball season more in the last 7 to 10 days than I'd had in the months beforehand. And there are some obvious reasons for that. But I also think that there's a little bit of a realization that that this has been, in some ways, getting sports started back up collegiately has been harder than I think a lot of people imagined it would have been when we shut down in March and April. I mean, I remember really optimistic discussions about summer ball. And obviously we saw how that went, where it was a little bit of a mixed bag. So I think there's also just a general realization about, hey, it might not be as easy to just say February, whatever the day is going to be this year, we're going to roll the balls out there and get going. And by the way, just, I know you've had several conversations with folks the same way that I have, that I think there's one thing that Teddy and I know very little about how the college baseball season is going to play out, because those factors have not, the factors that will be important there have not yet happened and have not yet played out. However, just in conversations that we've had, the season is not going to look like it has looked. There will be no normal looking college baseball season in 2021. Now, there are degrees of that, but there's going to be a lot different there. So I think it's important to set that expectation now, that it's not going to be 300 teams or whatever we end up with, you know, 300 teams starting on February, the second weekend in February, all at the same time, and everybody's going to play 50 to 56 games. It's not going to be that. And that much we can guarantee. But beyond that, a lot of what we see in the next 3, 4, 5 months is going to have a lot of bearing on what we see in February, March, and beyond.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of unknown. I think unknown is that it won't be what you're used to. But right now, if you gave me anything college baseball wise next spring, I think I'd be pretty happy about it. And I'm sure a lot of people can share in that sentiment. So
Agreed.
We'll continue tracking that. We'll continue tracking the football season, mostly because I just want to watch football, but also because it does have additional bearing on everything else that's happening right now. That's, a very important thing to remember when we're talking about college baseball or any other college sport. They don't happen in a vacuum. And when we're talking about baseball, it is important to remember that, much as Joe and I might prefer that it be a little further up the pecking order than it is, like, there are other things that are on, that supersede it in terms of revenue and therefore, attention given to it. And, look no further than any number of NCAA decisions that, the board of directors or the Division I council or whoever has handed down about baseball. And so you have to remember all of that when we're considering this. So, as it continues, we'll continue to track it, of course. But let's turn our attention to something a little more, I suppose certain, a little more fun to think about, I suppose. And that's our interview with Robert Woodard, the Niners, that he took over there in Charlotte, went 9-8 this season. And, if you look at their schedule, I would say the season was every bit as up and down as about a 500 record indicates. So, an interesting first season for Charlotte, but, definitely a lot of reasons to be excited. And he'll get into those with us here, as well as talk a little bit about, the player development aspect, which is a really important piece, both in his coaching story and just, in general in college baseball, of course, and kind of some of the unique ways that Charlotte has gone about player development in this unique situation that the pandemic has created. So let's get to our interview with Charlotte coach Robert Woodard. Today on the Baseball America College podcast, we're excited to welcome Charlotte head coach Robert Woodard to the program. Coach, it's been an interesting summer for everyone, interesting year for you in your first year as a head coach. But how are you handling this this unusual summer with all this additional downtime that we've had?
Yeah, no, I mean we're 5 months into uncharted territory, and if you've ever had a GPS with no roadmap, for the street you're on, that's kind of what it feels like in a way. Just trying to control what we can control here at Charlotte, just as an athletic department and as a program, all the cliches, one day at a time kind of thing. But it's really, you can wake up one morning right now and, the numbers can be getting better and we can feel like we're moving closer to getting back to normal. And then the numbers can shift, and all of a sudden there's more restrictions and protocols and things that you need to implement for players and everyone's safety. So, just trying to navigate that as best we can and communicate with our players as best we can, just, kind of the changes that are happening, although we hope temporary, but are happening, and just be prepared to make the best of, the hand we're dealt with, what the fall looks like and that sort of thing. We start a little bit later than all the other schools. We don't start until Monday, September 7th here. So it gives us a little bit more time to kind of see other schools and how, when they do come back, how it goes for them and some things that they do well and help them and kind of learn from them. So hopefully it'll be all positive and moving forward. But that's really it. I mean, it's a lot more virtual recruiting with watching streamed games and virtual visits, and calls and that sort of thing with players, and then the usual stuff with, your guys, this summer, guys were in summer ball and their team their season would get canceled. You have to put them onto another team. That season would get canceled and then put them onto another team, just trying to help really the position players find at bats. It's been priority for us. And then we've been fortunate this year, and this was planned pre-COVID, that we had as many as 18 of our pitchers training at Premier Pitching Performance, or P3, up in St. Louis, Missouri, for the last 10 weeks of the summer. So they were going up there anyways. But then when this all happened and summer leagues got canceled, it actually, I think it really benefited us to have a first-class state-of-the-art facility for our pitchers to, you know, to really train and program and everything from, you know, pitch design and 3D motion capture and you know, they have a weight room and all that stuff and obviously a place to throw and mound. So, you know, hopefully that'll pay off for us in terms of our pitching staff being ready when they come back this fall.
That's an interesting note here that, you know, your pitchers were already planning not to play summer ball this year, that they were able to, you know, have this other training facility. But in a world where you're not playing games this summer, whether that's, you know, by your staff's design or because of the pandemic, you know, it's not easy to, you know, get development, but because you guys had that arrangement set up, they were able to get some of that. What are you looking for in terms of what they're able to do over the summer at a facility, you know, where they're able to get the tech, get the weight training? What kind of are your goals for your pitchers when you send them there?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, for us, I just think over the years, one thing I've observed generally is that for whatever reason, most pitchers with a regular season that's not shortened by COVID, and then when they, you know, if they have a pretty heavy workload and then they go pitch summer ball, you know, a lot of guys in the past have been shut down from pitching in the fall. So when you have your guys back on campus, you can't even work with some of your best pitchers because they've had such a heavy workload. You know, and then other pitchers that are, you know, having, you know, maybe a light spring load and then a heavy workload in the summer, but they still need to compete because they're not where they want to be on the depth chart. You know, by the time they come back from summer ball, they're usually 5 to 10 pounds lighter. You know, they're a little bit, they're kind of in a fatigue state. There's some summer ball towns and places and teams, they have, you know, really great weight rooms and food options and that sort of thing. But what I found is that there's also some that don't. So, you know, that can really hinder a player's development. So I guess to get back to your question, I would say the thought process was, well, let's have all of our pitchers try to see if they can gain 5 to 10 pounds over the summer, get stronger, you know, have access to kitchens and good food, you know, being around their teammates from a camaraderie and competitive standpoint, you know, and then they're training at P3. So they're around, you know, like I said, 3D motion capture, high-speed cameras, Rapsodo, you know, and they're all watching each other throw and that sort of thing. So they're kind of getting an education on some of the newer methods in pitching, you know, whether it be pitch design or whatever it may be. You know, so they're getting a kind of a 10-week course on that. So now we're hopefully, you know, their goal is to come back with either a new pitch or an improved pitch, or certainly all of their pitches, you know, if they're coming back stronger and heavier. We think that they, you know, their stuff is more likely to take a jump than versus coming here in the fall in a fatigue state. So that's kind of the goal with our pitchers, really.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about on the hitting side with the pitchers. Obviously, you're kind of able to kind of send them all off as a group. But what's the approach of the hitters? Are they kind of spread out otherwise? What are the goals there? What does that look like for you guys?
Yeah, more traditional with the hitters. I mean, especially in a COVID-shortened season, you know, just really try to get them in the highest level of baseball as they can and let them play, let them get reps, let them get at bats as much as possible. So, you know, and then obviously in towns that have, you know, good facilities and good places for them to train. But more of a traditional setup, I think, with the hitters. I don't think that shifts too much with that, but so yeah, and they're, you know, so in this day and age, you know, this summer it was just all about finding a team that was playing. You know, in the summer, previous summers, it's about, you know, there's tons of different leagues and tons of different options, and you know, you can go to the Northwoods and play 70 games and get a ton of at bats, or you can go to the Coastal Plains League and get less at bats but be closer to home. You know, this summer it was just like there was a team that we could get our guys on. We want to get them on there. Our position players, we want to get them on there and play. So.
You played on the Cape. You coached on the Cape.
Yep.
How has your summer philosophy been, you know, shaped by that experience and other experiences that you've had around summer ball?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I pitched for three summers up in Chatham and I coached one summer in Orleans. So I've been kind of on both sides of that rivalry. And to me, I mean, the Cape's the best of the best. And I think any player in the country that has an opportunity to go play in Cape Cod, pitcher or hitter, needs to do that. I mean, it's a once in a lifetime opportunity. I was fortunate to get up there for four summers of my life, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. And, you know, so that, I mean, no matter what, that's always going to be a priority is if you know, our players can go play in that prestigious league, then we want to try it. We want to give them that opportunity. And it's no knock really on the other leagues. It's just, you know, it's just sort of, you know, I just think the Cape's different. And, you know, and just in this day and age where, you know, you see Major League Baseball and minor league baseball putting such an emphasis on development, and college baseball such an emphasis on development, you know, I think one thing that, you know, if there was a way for summer teams to really prioritize, you know, improving like the weight room and the food and, you know, opportunities for some of these guys, you know, cause I just remember, this is way back when, in 2004, 2005, and 2006, you know, I mean, I was playing in Chatham, and there really wasn't a whole lot of weight rooms up there, you know, and I can go back and look at pictures of myself and be like, you know, I wish the gym, you know, I wish there had been more of a gym opportunity, you know, there, but it just, you know, some of these towns are just not always available, you know, for one reason or another. So, yeah, I mean, to me, the Cape's the last best league, and anytime there's an opportunity for guys to play there, you know, we want our guys to play there.
Our J.J. Cooper spent a little time with you and your staff before the season, and for the listeners out there, I would highly recommend going back and reading what J.J. wrote about that experience. But
yeah, J.J. was great. That was fun. That was a fun day here on campus.
Yeah, he really enjoyed it as well. He raved about it quite a bit. But I'm curious about player development. So in college baseball, a lot of programs are singing from the same book now, which is great because that's good for the player. Yep. But from a competitive standpoint, the margins, at least in my opinion, you can tell me if I'm wrong, are thinning a little bit, where because everyone is a little bit on the same path here, how do you think about that, and how do you think about making sure that you guys are doing it a little bit better or a little bit different and being able to maintain at least some sort of competitive advantage in a world where the reality of the situation is, you know, you guys aren't going to have the budget of an SEC program. That's just kind of the reality of the situation.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, at the end of the day, like, you know, you have to have great players, not only physically, but just, you know, their makeup and their work ethic and everything that comes with it. So, you know, I think a team with a program with great players, you know, that are well-rounded and doing the right things and working hard, and, you know, their talent's really high. I mean, those programs are going to succeed, I believe, with or without, you know, being at the front end of player development. You know, for us, we just want to, we try to approach player development that, you know, what are we capable of doing, and let's try to do it, right? Like if, you know, they're like, what are the low hanging fruits, whether it's, you know, Rapsodo or driveline materials or high-speed cameras, axe bats, blast motion sensors, synergy, whatever it may be, just adding TVs into our indoor so that we have more visuals for our guys to coach themselves. You know, what are the low-hanging fruits that we can do? And let's not really focus on the things that we can't do or we don't have. You know, let's have goals to go get those things eventually. But let's make the most of what we have and just, you know, try to do those things well. I think that's for us is really important. And we want our guys to know that, you know, and really feel that every time they show up to the field, that they have the tools necessary to prepare, to compete and to improve their game to the highest level. So, you know, I mean, I think you know, there's all, I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, I've coached in the ACC, I've coached in Conference USA, I've coached in the CAA. It really, which are all three great leagues. And, you know, no matter where you are, there's always limitations. There's always something you don't have that you won't have, you want to have, or some obstacle. You know, to me, it's all about the mindset of, you know, what are we capable of doing, and let's do those things we are capable of, the best of our ability as a program.
You've now been in this job for a little more than a year. What have you learned? You know, I guess just about being a head coach, but also about your team in that time.
You know, I think. I don't know how long we have on this podcast. I've learned so much in the last year. And I'm very fortunate to, you know, have such a committed athletic department here with Mike Hill, our athletic director, Darren Spies, our sport administrator, and everything. Just the support from the top down, you know, for me is crucial. Anywhere, I think any coach in America would attest to that. And we're really fortunate, you know, when there's things that we need or things that we feel like we're capable of, you know, they want to say yes and they want to help. So, you know, we've had that this past year. But, you know, I mean, in terms of our players, I think there's times as coaches where we might not give our players enough credit. I mean, our players are, I mean, they're all over social media. They're reading, you know, information, they're watching videos constantly, you know, of what's being put out there, whether it's, you know, Trevor Bauer's, you know, video log or video blog, you know, where he's showing behind the scenes stuff and how he trains and how he goes about, you know, his work, you know. So I think as coaches, like, it's important for us to, one, try to stay up to speed or obviously ahead, but two, understand that, like, you know, our players are just as capable of, you know, once they're, you know, they're taught kind of the, you know, how to use technology or how to use some modern trading methods, like, they can grasp these things pretty quickly. And it doesn't need to be a 15-page post-game report. It can be a one-page report of things you really value. And they can really process these things and apply them to their games. So, you know, for me, I think giving your players more credit than maybe sometimes we do as coaches, you know, I think some coaches are afraid of message overload. Well, you know, I think it's important to try to, you know, give your players as much information as possible and then decide when to reel it back versus not give them enough.
We've had several coaches on the podcast this offseason who were in their first seasons in 2020. And as I start this question, Teddy probably knows where I'm going because I've asked it to all of them, and perhaps he's rolling his eyes there. But I'm curious how you approach your year two, given that year one was so short and was cut off early, because I can just imagine it would be a little bit difficult to make year two actually feel like a year two, as opposed to just like a 2-year long version of year one. But as you're building a program, obviously you don't want to be stuck back in year one. You kind of want to advance, but that seems like it would be a little bit harder to do given the circumstances.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a great point. And how you describe it, you know, it certainly at times feels that way, and you have to push to resist that. You know, I mean, I would imagine that the other first year head coaches you've spoken with, you know, I'd like to see their to-do lists. You know, I mean, my to-do list is pretty long, so it's hard for, it's, you know, there's days where there's one really important item that, you know, if we can just get this one thing done, then that is big for the program. You know, but sometimes, and then there's some days where you have to do 20 to 30 little things, you know, and get those things checked off. So, you know, I think as long as you're maintaining a to-do list of short and long-term things to accomplish as a program, then, you know, I think you're, you know, the likelihood of you becoming stagnant or stuck, you know, back in year one is going to be difficult, because you're always, you know, trying to check off new boxes. So, you know, that's probably something I would say is something that all the first year head coaches that you've probably spoken with, we can probably all relate to, is that our to-do lists are all very long, and, you know, and it just, and it covers a wide range of things. I mean, everything from, I mean, we're designing uniforms because we just We have a total rebrand of our athletic department with all new logos and everything. So, you know, we're getting six sets of uniforms. So we want to design our uniforms, you know, how we want them to look. And, you know, we're putting new graphics all over our stadium and our locker room and stuff like that. So, you know, it's really hard. It's really hard to really kind of have, I don't have too many times where I come in and I feel like we're kind of stuck in year one. It feels like we've embraced momentum here for sure.
What is it that attracted you to this job? You know, you're one of the younger coaches in Division One. You were, you know, an assistant coach at North Carolina. There seemingly was no reason for you to jump into a job that you didn't really want. So what is it about this one that made you, go out and take it last summer?
I grew up here. You know, my parents live 25 minutes away from our stadium here on campus. So it's not every day, I don't think, that you get to coach college baseball in your hometown. And, you look at what Coach Hibbs was here for 27 years. You know, I mean, I think when you look at any job in any profession, you know, I would say look at, you know, where was the previous, you know, what did the previous person in your position do? Was he successful? Did he have a good experience? Did he respect it? And, you know, everybody respects Coach Hibbs tremendously, and he was here for 27 years. So, you know, I felt like the opportunity to, you know, continue what he had done, you know, and even try to escalate things to new heights. It's very possible here, I guess. I grew up in Charlotte, North Carolina. So, you know, I knew Coach Hibbs as a young player in middle school and high school and the program here. And I followed all those teams that were really talented in the late 90s. And then, you know, the 2000s when I was a player, and then the good teams since. And, you know, it's Charlotte, North Carolina. We have one of the biggest airports in the country. And I think I read somewhere that like 70% of the United States can fly to Charlotte, North Carolina in under 3 hours. So, you know, it's very, very accessible. I mean, you're going to see it in our recruiting class. I mean, we've got a big recruiting class coming in, and they're from all over the country. And it's a credit to, you know, our location, but it's also a credit to once players come here and they see this campus and they see our facilities, and they meet the people that are here, part of our program and this athletic department, you know, and then we go uptown on their visit and they see the skyline and they see the city and they feel the connection between the campus and the city. You know, to me, this job last summer was a no-brainer. I mean, it was a no-brainer. I interviewed, I didn't know how much the job paid. I didn't know how many years the contract were. I didn't even know the balance of the, you know, the roster of the 11.7, none of that really mattered to me. I mean, it was, you know, coming here was much bigger than all of that. So, you know, for me, I really do have a dream job coaching in my hometown city.
One of the best stories of the major league season so far has been the return of Daniel Bard, a classmate of yours at UNC. Yep. What has that been like for those? I guess, who don't know, Daniel Bard was a big leaguer and then struggled with control issues and, by his own admission, the yips, and then has kind of battled his way back and is now a big leaguer again. So, Coach, what has that been like, watching that progress, knowing the struggles he's had and be able to get back to the mountaintop?
Just really, really proud, you know, really proud of my really good friend who, I mean, it's a one-of-a-kind story, you know, like there's nobody that's doing what he's, you know, that's done what he's doing. And to our close circle of friends, it's not really a surprise because, I mean, even like 3 years ago when he was kind of making another comeback, I never saw him throw a fastball under 94. So it's like, I've never seen Daniel Bard throw a fastball under 94 in my life. And that's like, I mean, he can wake up and get out of bed, you know, show up to the field, not even stretch his arm, get on a mound and throw a ball at 94, 95 without even doing anything. Like it's just crazy. you know, but on top of the natural talent, I mean, he's worked extremely hard to keep his body and, you know, as mobile as it is and as strong as it is. And, you know, and now everybody's, you know, kind of getting to see him put it all together and just show everybody in baseball that really anything is possible. And you know, you can come back from anything and you just have to try and you just have to believe. And, you know, it's just really fun to watch. I think he's going to stay up there for a few more years. And, you know, just really proud of my good friend because, you know, it certainly has not been easy for him the last 7 years or so.
Staying on a UNC theme here, you know, we got news as we record this today on the 7th that Mike Fox, your coach at UNC, is retiring after 22 seasons there. You played for him. You coached with him. Just what has Mike Fox meant to you and your baseball life? And you know, just what are your thoughts on him reaching, you know, retirement?
Yeah, I mean, Mike Fox changed my life. And as a senior in high school, he offered me a $1,000 scholarship to go play baseball at, you know, my parents' alma mater. Honestly, you know, I think I went to camp there so many times. I think he just kind of gave me my camp refund, you know, to go play there. But he, you know, he deserves this. He really deserves this. He did it. He's done it the right way from day one. He did it the right way at North Carolina Wesleyan. And then when he got hired in 1998 for the last 22 years, he has done everything the right way from, you know, just how to compete, how to develop players, how to develop men off the field. You know, he's a great husband. He's a great father. He's just class. I mean, he's a cutthroat competitor between the lines, but he carries himself with class and grace like really no other coach I've been around. And I'm just very, very thankful that, you know, I've coached for 10 years now in college baseball and 5 of them have been sitting next to him in the dugout and all 4 of my years as a player. So not, you know, I've gotten 9 years of experience, you know, being around Coach Fox on a daily basis and having a front row seat of what the best of the best in college baseball looks like. You know, he's just so consistent, you know, the excellence is just so consistent. But I'm just so, and saying all that, I'm sure it's a very small percentage of coaches that really, they get to choose when they walk away. And, you know, he called me last night and he said, Woody, I haven't worn a watch in 3 weeks. And I said, well, good for you, coach. And, you know, he deserves that. So, you know, and then obviously my best friend, Scott Forbes, being named the new head coach there is, again, it just shows you that the game knows and good things happen to good people. And I think my alma mater is in tremendous hands, really the best hands with Scott Forbes.
Well, it's going to be very interesting to see how the program progresses there, but I'm also very curious to see how the Niners progress and, you know, 2021 feels like a long time away and a lot of uncertainty still surrounding that. But what are you looking forward to as you look at the next season in Charlotte baseball?
Well, you know, we haven't announced our schedule, but we have a great schedule. You know, without going into too much detail, I mean, we're going to play 35 home games here. Love our ballpark. We have a tremendous relationship with the Charlotte Knights uptown. So we're actually in the works right now. We're getting pretty close to announcing, the game. We're going to play some games up in their ballpark, which in my opinion is the nicest minor league ballpark in the country. You know, so we're going to play a really great schedule here. And then we've got a really exciting recruiting class coming in that Toby Bicknell, our recruiting coordinator, and Bo Robinson, our associate head coach, have really spearheaded, you know, and been the architects of bringing this class in. We're excited about it. It's versatile. It's You know, it comes from, you know, high school, but also heavy junior college. And we've got some four-year transfers that are immediately eligible. So, you know, we're just excited, you know, to combine them with the players that are coming back who are really talented and really bought into everything we're doing. It just feels like it's a really exciting time, you know, for Niner baseball and going into 2021.
Outstanding. Well, we'll be looking forward to seeing that and see what you guys have cooking up out there. Certainly an exciting time in the program, what with the rebrand that you mentioned and all those new uniforms and the big recruiting class and, you know, just a lot of new in Charlotte and, you know, specifically within the baseball program, I guess.
Yeah, you know, it starts with Mike Hill, our athletic director, who leads that energy, and it just kind of spreads, you know, throughout. I mean, I'm one of six head coaches, maybe seven, that have been hired, I think, in the last 2 years here. You know, with Coach Healy leading the football program to a bowl game, Ron Sanchez. I mean, I thought they were going to win the Conference USA basketball tournament right before COVID hit. He was the recruiting coordinator at Virginia that recruited the national title basketball team. So, you know, there's a ton of energy here in the athletic department and momentum, and you know, you feel it each and every day when we come in the offices. So it's a special place for sure.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Coach, to break down all of that for us. It was great talking with you here on the Baseball America College podcast.
Yeah, well, thanks, Joe, and thanks, Teddy, for having me. And you know, looking forward to seeing you guys out here this fall, hopefully under more normal circumstances, hopefully for scrimmages, and then certainly next spring. Appreciate all you guys do for the game.
Thank you again to Charlotte head coach Robert Woodard for joining us here on the Baseball America College podcast. Joe, I wanted to bring on Coach Woodard in large part to talk about some of this player development stuff, because the piece that he's talking about with the pitchers going to P3, you know, kind of caught my attention when he mentioned that on Twitter this week. And, you know, summer ball is obviously a different scenario this year, but hearing him talk about how they had planned to send all of their pitchers there makes it even more interesting, because we have seen in recent years kind of the growth of, you know, these alternate summer plans where you can go, you don't have to play games to develop. You can go and you can train and you can, you know, get stronger and use various tech to work on specific pitches or your delivery or whatever. And, you know, from a pitching standpoint, it really seems like that's kind of a growing trend, a thing that's becoming more popular around college baseball, and you see the success that some of those guys have, and you know, you hear Coach Woodard explain it, and you know, it certainly you know, doesn't, I don't think that's going away anytime soon. And you know, so as we consider what player development looks like in the summer, you know, especially when we talk about the potential of the new model in college baseball, you know, these are all very interesting things to think about. And I appreciated him sharing his perspective with us here.
Yeah, it was really interesting stuff. And I think that choice they made is, and the fact that choice was available, I think is reflective of where player development is, even at the college level, because these options just weren't available not so long ago. There was a time when it was kind of summer ball or nothing. And of course that's an oversimplification, but that's largely what it was you went to summer ball, or you could, you know, if you're rehabbing an injury, that was a little different or what have you. And then I think more and more you started to hear players say, well, I stayed on campus and I lifted weights, or I stayed on campus and I worked on my conditioning or what have you, or did some, you know, just one-on-one instruction. You started to hear that. And now to your point, I think you're hearing more and more examples of players or groups of players going off to specific training camps, if you will, kind of like what Charlotte did to train this way. Bryce Jarvis famously at Duke did so before last season, and you saw the fruits of that labor. So I do think this is going to be more and more common thing as time goes on. Now there are a finite number of places where that kind of thing can be done. Certainly it'd be easier in a non-pandemic year to pull this kind of thing off, you know, send a big group of your players off and feel comfortable with that. But I do think it continues to be a thing that we see. And there are a number of reasons for that. I mean, there are a lot of ways in which doing something like that can give a coach a little bit of peace of mind. Cause you are ceding a lot of control in summer ball. And that's part of the reason why the coaches that coaches trust get the players they do. I mean, you saw with Tom Holliday, the players he got in Tulsa. And I think a lot of that is because he's Tom Holliday. And, you know, Bill Pintard and the West Coast with the Santa Barbara Foresters is this guy that coaches trust to take care of their players and do right by their players. And so outside of those, though, there is a little bit of mystery with summer ball and kind of what you're going to get. And the goals for your player might not jive with the goals of the rest of the team or the coach or any, you know, things like that. So I think it's an opportunity for a lot of coaches to be able to have a little more direct input on exactly what the guys are working on, the goals they have, the inputs and the output. They're kind of aware of that as it's happening. Summer ball is a little more ephemeral, if you will. And there's still value in that. I'm not suggesting there's not. I think, and even Coach Woodard, you know, they've got hitters out in summer ball, and he mentioned it too, that they're just different goals. And for some guys, it might be to go out there and compete more. And so that's a situation where you send a guy to summer ball because you want him to face live hitters in game situations that can't really be replicated in a warehouse or on a training mound. So there are opportunities in summer ball. I still think I'm not suggesting this is a doomsday type thing for summer ball, although perhaps the new model is that maybe, but that's a discussion for a different day. But I thought it's really interesting. I'm a fan of just in general, a fan of outside the box ideas. And so I really was intrigued by this, and I could have probably asked him 30 minutes more of questions about the logistics of that, you know, and the discussions that he had with his players about that. And are the players all living together? Are they, you know, are they doing host families? But there's a lot of like logistical questions that are interesting, even beyond the COVID piece of it. But we just didn't have time for all of that. So yeah, interesting stuff. And I think, you know, he's really, and I think this is part of what JJ wrote in that story that I alluded to in the interview, is that, you know, he's really kind of sped up Charlotte quite a bit in a short amount of time there in terms of bringing in tech, bringing in new player development methods. And I think this kind of just falls in line with what he's doing there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you read JJ's story, like you'll see P3 referenced, like they have kind of a longstanding relationship, I guess, at this point. But between, you know, them and the program, it is, you know, he mentioned that he would like to see more summer teams kind of go in on like weight rooms and that kind of developmental piece of it. And, you know, I think that's something that you hear fairly commonly if you talk to college people, like what they would hope that summer ball could add, or what they could add, what summer ball could add that could, you know, lead them to giving more players, you know, keeping them out longer in the summer, sending them out or whatever. Just the infrastructure that they have on campus is so much greater than what you have at a lot of summer ball locations. And, you know, it's just such a big part of player development in 2020 that, you know, that's something that they're looking for and that, you know, could be kind of a, competitive advantage if you could get, you know, that kind of thing going in your summer league. You know, I know some summer ball places are, you know, well aware of that and working on that. And, you know, it's never going to be as good as what they have on campus. Those facilities cost an awful lot of money for a reason, but the any improvement in that, I think, would be welcomed by a lot of people within college baseball. So yeah, that's something to, that's another trend to watch as we go forward, is especially in terms of pitchers, how are they using the summer to develop? Are they doing it on campus? are colleges finding creative ways, like Charlotte is doing, to bring development to the summer, or, you know, does summer ball, you know, kind of swing back and find a way to recapture, you know, some of the players that they're currently losing, you know, to staying on campus or to these other private facilities.
I think it's also Woodard making the decision to do this. I think part of the reason part of the reason I asked the question to him about how do you, it's more or less just how do you stay ahead in development, because look, Charlotte has what they need from a player development standpoint. To your point, they are way ahead of a lot of schools in a similar place in the college baseball hierarchy. But it is always kind of a game of catch up a little bit, and a lot of schools are kind of looking at things the same way now in terms of player development. There are a lot fewer schools that are kind of in the Stone Ages in terms of using some of this new technology and the new player development methods, which is not, by the way, to say that's the only way to do it in the sport, but more and more are going that way. But the fact that, you know, he's kind of appears to be on the leading edge a little bit of doing this with the summer, it to me suggests that Charlotte's in a good position and has a guy in charge who is going to really spend a lot of time thinking ahead to what's next, as opposed to really being stuck on what they're doing right now. And I think that bodes well for Charlotte, and we don't have to do the Charlotte deep dive right now, just because I'm certainly not prepared for that discussion. But just on its face, you know, Charlotte is a program within Conference USA that I think has a lot of things going for it and should be more of a have versus a have not within the league. And I think they're in a position now with some of the advancements they've made. The facility is good. Obviously, you're in a great location. He referenced some of that. I think they're in a really, really good position, even setting aside hiring Robert Woodard, but to bring in someone like Robert Woodard, who I think is thinking about the right things when it comes to how do I get my program from where they are to that next level. And he's thinking about those kinds of things without being unrealistic about it, without being hyperbolic about it. He's not out here talking about, you know, Project Omaha 2024 or something like that. I mean, he seems to really have his mind wrapped around like the kind of incremental improvements they need to make to get where they want. And I think that's all really good news for the program.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And I would echo that we're not going to deep dive Charlotte, in part because he referenced their large new recruiting class. And I think that's going to be a large part of the story for Charlotte going forward, that if you look at their roster last year, they were pretty old, and yes, seniors can come back, but you know, they have had a fair amount of, there's going to be a fair amount of new when you go look at Charlotte next year. And you know, they have some exciting players, you know, that out there for them. But I think, like he said, like a lot of the excitement is about what's coming in. And this isn't to say that, again, that Charlotte was a solid team. But they, if they're going to be upgrading over the summer with this 2020 recruiting class, you know, it's going to be exciting to see what that looks like when it all comes together for them. So definitely kind of a program on the rise, especially within the context of Conference USA. And I would definitely agree that they should be much more of a have. When you look at them, you know, there's no reason why they can't be, you know, where Southern Miss and Louisiana Tech and FAU and, you know, Rice, why Charlotte can't be on that level, I would say.
Also helpful, he mentioned new uniforms. And look, I'm not a sartorial guy. I am, you know, colorblind. And also, as my fiance will tell you, dress horribly. However, I can have occasional opinions on baseball uniforms and what they've been working with. Not great, in my opinion. So I'm looking forward to rebranded uniforms, because I think that'll be a positive change as well.
Yeah, we'll see what they come up with there. Six new uniforms. It's a lot. We'll see what it looks like.
Yeah, just a little generic. It's not that it was anything super garish they were working with. It's just pretty generic, you know, which sometimes that's great. But I think they could use a little fresh coat of paint, if you will.
All right, so let's get to the last bit of news we wanted to get to here today, and that is a big piece with Mike Fox announcing his retirement in North Carolina, picking Scott Forbes as his successor. Neither are surprises if you look in the long term, but in the immediate, you know, I certainly did not wake up on Friday expecting that, and you know, it being August, it wasn't really something that was particularly on my radar as a thing that might happen imminently or even this year. It is a massive retirement in the sport. Mike Fox ranks 7th on the all-time wins list. He really made North Carolina into a national power, and Scott Forbes now, who has kind of been the heir apparent for, I don't know, 5-6 years at least, I would say probably, he'll get his chance starting with that 2021 season. So Joe, like, let's start with Mike Fox's impact and just kind of general profile. When you consider what he has done at North Carolina, certainly one of the greats within college baseball.
No doubt about it. I think when you think of North Carolina as a power program, you have Mike Fox to thank for that. They were a good program before. This is certainly no disrespect to Mike Roberts, the coach before Mike Fox, the father of big leaguer Brian Roberts. He did a really nice job there for 20 years, but Mike Fox took it to another level. Certainly with that run they had, you know, in 2006, 2009, four straight Omaha appearances. Heck of a run there. Came up just short on national titles. I know that's probably something that, you know, people around the program have lost a little bit of sleep over through the years. But yeah, he's the catalyst behind North Carolina becoming what we know North Carolina baseball to be now. And I, you know, I was not quite as plugged in on college baseball yet when he, you know, certainly when he first took the job, I was not really paying a ton of attention. But up until that run they had from 2006, 2009, you know, there was kind of just a general feeling around North Carolina that this was also around the time they were building the new Bosch in Boschmer Stadium. And so there was kind of just a thought that this program is really about to pop. And sure enough, it did. Because before that, there was a little bit of a feeling of, they just hadn't quite gotten over the hump, maybe a little underachieving, you know, they should maybe be a little more than they are. And then boom, there it was. And they've stayed fairly consistent. They have had some ups and downs in recent years. They are not immune from having the occasional season where they kind of fall flat. But on the whole, they've been incredibly, incredibly consistent. A number of College World Series appearances. Let's see if I'm counting here. That's 7 since 2006. That is one heck of a run. So a well-deserved retirement for sure for turning the North Carolina program into what it is today.
Yeah, absolutely. He only missed the tournament 3 times as North Carolina's head coach. One of those times definitely stains North Carolina, as they were probably the last team out. Probably not something you want to bring up with people around the program too much. But yeah, they, incredibly consistent under him. You know, Fox took UNC to 4 straight College World Series, 5 and 6 years. No ACC team had been 4 straight years before UNC did it. The 2, College World Series finals appearances are within that 4-year run, losing both times to Oregon State. Again, just a real tough, you know, unable to get over the hump there. But North Carolina became one of the ACC's premier programs under Mike Fox. They're one of the few programs that, like, truly recruits nationally. They have a gem of a stadium. It's just a really, really strong program that is, you know, that he's built there. And, you know, yeah, they had a pretty good program before he showed up, but, you know, it's definitely fair to say he took them to another level. And now it's going to be Scott Forbes' job to maintain that. Forbes, like I mentioned, 19 years on Fox's staff. He's done just about anything you can do. He's been their recruiting coordinator. He's been their hitting coach. He's been their pitching coach. He's really had a hand in shaping these teams. He's coached third base. Like, he's almost literally done everything, I think. And, you know, that's going to serve him well. Fox has a pretty solid coaching tree. Chad Holbrook, Scott Jackson, Robert Woodard, all former assistants who have gone on to become head coaches. Now Forbes joins that list, and he gets the job there in Chapel Hill. I think he has everything he needs to be successful. He's a really well-respected coach. He could have been a head coach elsewhere by now if he had chosen to leave. He was in the running for the Pitt job a couple of years ago when Mike Bell got it. Forbes pulled his name out. I don't know that Forbes was going to get the job if he had stayed in, but he's been mooted as a potential ACC head coach before, and now he's going to get that opportunity in Chapel Hill. And I'm going to be interested to see what he does with it. I don't see any reason why North Carolina has to take a step back under Forbes. Obviously, losing a coach like Mike Fox is hugely significant, and Forbes is a first-time head coach. He'll have some growing pains to go through, no doubt, but it's a program that's well set up to succeed. And I think Forbes is, he's 100% earned the opportunity to be the successor to Mike Fox here.
I think it actually says something, because you're right that, like, pound for pound, it's a really good coaching tree. And I think it actually says something that it's not bigger, because, you know, he's had a lot of the same assistants. It's been a pretty static group for a long, long time, which is great for the program, obviously. You get that continuity. And it created a guy like Forbes, who was kind of an obvious successor by the time it was all said and done. But that coaching tree in a lot of places would be bigger by now, but the coaches have stuck with the program, have stuck with Mike Fox. And I think that speaks volumes about him and the program and what they've created there, that guys aren't looking to necessarily jump ship. You know, guys aren't jumping at any opportunity. They're waiting for the right opportunities. And for a lot of his coaches, that right opportunity has come along. But it has been a group that's been pretty tenured. So I think there's something to be said about that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with that. And, you know, it's a talented coaching staff. There's a reason why North Carolina is as successful as it is. And a lot of that has to do with that staff and what they can do for players. And Mike Fox, definitely one of the college baseball greats. I mean, just, again, seventh all-time in career wins, and really, really impressive run in Chapel Hill. I guess, like Mike Martin, you can say that the resume is missing the national title, and that is a disappointment, I am sure. But I think Mike Fox is going to look on the balance and be very happy with how his career went. Just being able to coach at his alma mater, produce the results they produced and produce a lot of talent. I'm sure that they would talk about the quality of their players as well as humans. And I'll let them speak to that more than me. They would know better than I. But from what I can tell, it's a well-run program from top to bottom.
Isn't it amazing a little bit too? We talk about the lack of a national title, and obviously that's something we have to talk about. Like, that's our job, to kind of put these coaches kind of in categories and kind of unofficially rank them and put them in a hierarchy. But isn't it kind of amazing that, you know, during their careers, they might talk a little bit about it. Mike Martin kind of famously said he let it go, you know, about a decade prior to retirement or whatever it was. And I assume Mike Fox got to that point at some point in his career as well. But it's kind of amazing that these coaches, when they get, and it seems genuine, by the way, but these coaches, when they get to retirement and they get to a point where they're just ready, and if you read the release that, you know, you quoted a little bit in your story, and folks can go online and read it, but the statement he gave, which just kind of talked about how he's had a chance to, like, slow down and see what life would be like once he was done, and he kind of liked it in a lot of ways. And I think Mike Martin was very much in that kind of place as well. In his life, and was ready to kind of do something else with his next chapter. And it's kind of amazing to me that we spend a lot of time discussing it. And at some points, maybe it's been a topic of conversation for them as well. But by the time you're ready to go and you're ready to move on to the other chapter, that stuff kind of seems to melt away. And I think that's kind of like an important just general life lesson that when you're hanging them up, like that stuff tends to kind of fade away and you're more focused on the good you see in what you've done, whether it's through your players or through your coaches or what you've built. And then you're just kind of looking forward to being a husband again or being a dad again or whatever it is. I think there's probably something to be learned from that, because it struck me how often you see that with coaches that maybe fell a little bit short time and time again, and how at peace they just kind of seem with that by the time it's all said and done.
I've talked to a lot of people close to Mike Martin over the last couple of years, and they basically all will tell you that the thing that makes him happiest is seeing former players come back around with their families. And some of that is just like seeing people that you haven't seen in a while, but that he genuinely is really into like getting to know the man that they've become. And like, he really likes seeing how they've grown and, you know, started families. And I think that's relatively common among college coaches. Now, Mike Martin probably takes it to more of an extreme than many. That's part of who he is. That's part of what makes him who he is. But I would guess that Mike Fox is in a similar situation where, you know, if you're in college baseball, if you're in college anything, part of what you want to do on some level is develop people, right? Because you're choosing to work with young people. And, you know, if you wanted to just care about like the pure on coaching aspect, you'd probably be somewhere in pro ball. But, you know, college sets you up with these restrictions about what you can and can't do, you know, limits the number of hours you can work with them on the field. So why do you put up with this, or what else do you get out of it? You get the human side. And you want to focus on the human side. And so I think that's part of why these guys talk about it that way. And, you know, Mike Fox, you know, really does seem to care about the family aspect of it. And, you know, he really cares about his own family a lot. And, you know, that's part of the reason why he's walking away now. And, you know, it's easy to get that. It's also easy to see how, you know, a competitor like a Mike Fox would be really frustrated that, you know, they didn't win the national title. But, you know, yeah, you're right. Like eventually that stuff probably fades away. And, you know, it's really, really, really hard to win a national title. Like that's one thing to take away here is that, you know, that when you look at the teams that North Carolina had over the years, you know, the talent, Andrew Miller, Matt Harvey, Daniel Bard, Dustin Ackley, Kyle Seager. You know, it's a really impressive group, Colin Moran, and they weren't able to get it done. It's just really hard to do, but there is more to it than just the pure wins and the losses, as important as those are to all of these men who coach college baseball. All right, so we'll leave it there for this week. It's a pretty meaty episode. As I said, kind of a randomly busy Friday here in August, but we'll have more to come in the weeks as we get closer to fall, and whatever that means for fall ball and college baseball. We'll continue to bring you that here on the Baseball America College Podcast. So I would encourage you to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast app, Apple Podcast, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you're listening to podcasts, you can find us. Please subscribe, please rate, review, do whatever you can. All of that stuff helps us and helps other people to find the podcast. So we greatly appreciate all of that. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy, BA. And I would encourage you to check out all of the works that we've referenced throughout the show here over at baseballamerica.com. There is plenty to read, both in the college baseball realm and beyond, as you know, the minor leagues continue to try and figure out what they're going to look like in the future. JJ Cooper all over that, and the major leagues continue their season. So check all of that out over at baseballamerica.com. Joe and I will be back here next week with another edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. Until then, I want to thank you guys for listening. Thanks to Joe. Thanks to Robert Woodard for joining us. We'll see you next time here on the Baseball America College Podcast.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medela is your reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.